Open our Bibles up to 1 Samuel chapter 4. 1 Samuel 4. We have some interesting material to cover tonight. We'll come across some things that are not usually covered. But when you go through the Bible book by book, it forces you to cover things that otherwise you might bypass. This is why most preaching is usually concentrated either in the Gospels or in a few of the epistles. But in going through books, verse by verse, you are forced to handle these matters. And here are some illustrations of some very important truths. I want you to keep this in mind when you go through 1 Samuel, that there are some definite parallels between the days of Samuel and our own day. Now, it is a policy, I guess, for preachers to always try to make it appear as if things are really worse than they are. But I am not trying to do that, please believe me. I try to be fair with what I see going on in this country, and I realize that there is a sense in which man has always been evil, and that mankind has always been committing injustice against mankind. But nevertheless, there is in human history the obvious fact that nations do rise and fall. That nations go through cycles. They do not have to, but many of the great civilizations have gone through, all of these have gone through these cycles. The cycle is somewhat like the following. The cycle is establishment and pioneering based upon the vigor and the aggressiveness of the people. The vigor of the people is often associated with a number of mores by which they live. Such things as discipline, loyalty, responsibility, courage, determination. And in a nation where the Word of God has had a real impact, there is a pronounced climate of moral values, such things as respect for the privacy of others, the property of others, the respect for human life, the restraining of sin in terms of adequate law enforcement, a good defense, and a people who are vigorous and who recognize the importance of the work ethic and who are generally follow a line of policy of honesty and integrity characterizes the majority of the people. But a nation may lapse after a period of time, and by rejecting the institutions that God has established, such as the ultimate issue of authority, when divine authority is rejected, and when that authority is rejected by the deterioration within the home, and when homes begin to disintegrate, you will find a gradual breakup of that society. No longer do you find the virtues of honesty, integrity, loyalty, courage. These things become corny. They become passé to many people. And rather than having a spirit of patriotism, there is a spirit of cynicism. And that is usually one of the signs of a dying culture. Now, what we have in our own nation is that we are in the death throes of our own nation's history. I think we might see our nation go along for a number more years after we're dead and gone. But we're seeing our nation having reached a period of time in which there was a bit of integrity and patriotism, loyalty, responsibility, that kind of thing. But we're seeing it wane. And so we have seen the effects of apostasy. Now, apostasy is the rejection of biblical truth. To apostatize is to stand off from a position previously held. And what we have seen in our nation is that we have seen many religious bodies develop in the realm of apostasy. And once there were those schools that were established for the purpose of training ministers. But these schools have become the training places of modern liberalism. I'm thinking of places like Harvard and Yale and Princeton and other schools like them. At one time, these schools were established for the training of preachers and missionaries. But now they are the places established for the furtherance of liberal political philosophy. And so with that has come a decadence and a deterioration in the general life of our country, not in terms of material things. We do not measure the values and the real things in life by material things. That is where many people are completely fooled, because they think that because we have a greater period of prosperity than we've ever had before, that this is progress. Well, that is not progress in the absolute sense. But what we're seeing is an erosion of the really valuable things, the really important things. We have a period of time in Samuel, like our own day, when there were very few believers. And what few believers there were, they had allowed the world philosophy, the philosophy of the Canaanites, to intrude, to infiltrate their own worship, to infiltrate their own philosophy of life. The Canaanites were an idolatrous people. They were people who worshiped many gods. They worshiped the fertility god, Baal. And they did this with immorality, ranging all the way from homosexuality to bestiality, child sacrifice. The Canaanites were a corrupt and decadent people. Now, they became that over a period of time. And when Israel moved in alongside of them, that Canaanite culture gradually influenced and infiltrated the culture in Israel. And Israel had been established around the law of God under a theocracy. And when we come into the book of 1 Samuel, we are in a period in Israel's history when the law is eclipsed by apostasy. Israel has rejected the covenant that God had established with her. There are very few believers. And we find that there is a lack of the instruction from the God, from the Word of God. Very little prophetical preaching was going on. It is said in 1 Samuel 3 that the Word of the Lord was rare in those days, meaning that there was very little revelation coming from God through prophets, for there were very few prophets, if any. In the fourth chapter, we're going to look at the wages of sin. That is, what does this apostasy result in after it is set in over a period of time? It's like a fermentation process. As it has been fermenting, what is the outcome of the fermentation process? I'm talking about the decaying of a culture, the wages of sin in a culture and in a man's life. Let's pray before we look at that, though. Lord, we look to you to guide us in the study, because we are dependent on your Holy Spirit. We need the enlightenment that only your Spirit can give us. And Lord, may this study of the times of Samuel enlighten us and alert us to our own times, so that we will be more alert to the spiritual dangers that beset us daily. And do that for us through the study tonight. In the name of Christ, this is asked. Amen. Now, in order to get you up to the fourth chapter, if you've not been here previously, 1 Samuel is dealing with a period in Israel's history which links two great periods in her history. The first was that period of which Israel had experienced in coming into the land and establishing her presence in Canaan. She came into Canaan and conquered cities like Jericho, like Ai. These cities and others fell before them under General Joshua. Israel established her presence. But unfortunately, Israel did not completely eliminate the Canaanites. And it's like a cancer when it's operated upon. If it is not completely removed, it's going to spread its malignancy. So Israel has been in the land under Joshua. She went into a period of time sketched in the book of Judges, when we might could say under this title that it was a time in Israel's history when every man did that which was right in his own eyes. The law of God was set aside. She would be oppressed by some of her neighbors in the land, some of the Canaanites. She would be oppressed and would lose her freedoms. Then God would raise up a judge, and this man would free her from that oppression, as in the case of Samson and the temporary relief from the Philistine oppression. There is another period of history that we're going to see develop later on in Samuel, and that is the period of the theocracy, or the monarchy, rather. She had been in a theocracy. She will go into a monarchy where she will demand a king like the other nations. And God will grant her a king, and the first of those kings will be Saul. But we're in a transition period where Israel's spiritual life is at a low ebb. And we're watching Samuel grow up as a young man, because God has laid his hand on Samuel and is making him to be the man who's going to stand in the gap between these two periods of time and is going to be the one who will say, "Thus saith the Lord." He will anoint Israel's first king. He will be the man who will judge and who will preach. So So he is a very important person in Israel's history, but we're watching him grow, and we're seeing the times in which he grew. Now, in the fourth chapter, we're seeing some of the results of a sin that a father committed within his own family. This man was Eli. He was the high priest in Israel. He was responsible not only for Israel, but for his own family. Apparently, he was fairly faithful in his responsibilities toward the people. But when it came to his own family, he was defective. And being a defective father eventually brought the downfall of the nation. So you can write this note down. It's a very important principle that though you may fulfill your responsibilities in society, if you fail toward your family, you will fail toward society. You do not build society on the basis of carrying out your functions in your job description. And this is where many fathers have completely failed. They have failed our nation by not failing so much in their jobs, but failing in their responsibility as the father. And when they have relinquished their responsibility as a father, they have failed their society. For their society will suffer from the deterioration of the family. You cannot have a stable society without stable home life. And Eli failed as a father. Now we know what Eli's area of weakness was. He lacked self-control. He passed this lack of self-control on to his children, Hophni and Phinehas. Now it did not come to them genetically, other than that they did get a sin nature from their parents, but it was learned behavior. They learned their sinful behavior from their father Eli. Apparently Eli couldn't control his appetite. You know, it was the custom to provide for the priest part of the sacrifice that you brought. The priest would take out part of that. That would be food on his table. The rest would be offered to the Lord in a burnt offering. Now, what Eli liked to do, and apparently his sons after him, that they liked to take the choice cuts of meat. And his sons especially took the meat that was not only a choice cut of meat, the loin, but they liked to take even other parts. So apparently they were gluttonous as well as greedy. Now we have in the fourth chapter of 1 Samuel, in the first four or five verses, we have a very tragic period in this in Eli's life and in the lives of his two sons, where we see that the word of the Lord of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle. The Philistines were that people that had established themselves in the southwestern part of the land. This area here where you see the cities Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, Gath, Ekron. There were five major Philistine cities. The Philistines were the sea people. They had come in probably from the Isle of Crete. It is suggested by some that the development of the Aegean civilization, that is the early parts of the Greek civilization, as it began to develop and out of the Minoan civilization, this pressed these people on into the east, and they came into this part of the land. There were already other people from the sea who had immigrated into here. And what had happened is that the Philistines then absorbed Canaanite culture. Now these people rule the plain. This is called the Plain of Sharon. It's the coastal plain. Right through here, I do not have the geographical map on top of this to show you, but running right up and down the land this way is what is called the Shephelah, or the foothills. This is the central ridge country upon which Jerusalem sits. But the Philistines control this area. But they began to make their press against Israel, for they did for about 40 years, in this direction. And what happened in that the battle of Ebenezer, and that is the place that's in the battle that's described here in verses 1 through 3, that Israel went out to meet the Philistines. The Philistines controlled the plains because they had the chariot. That was the atomic bomb. That was the weapon. And to have had that weapon mean that in the open country you could call the shots. And Israel suffered a tragic defeat at this time. When the people came into the camp, this is after they had already lost 4,000 people on the battlefield, the Israelites came back and they said this, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" Could not understand why they had lost. Now you may wonder why they would ask such a question. Are they to win all their battles? I mean, after all, can a team win every game? Well, in Israel's case, she had a very unusual foreign policy and a very unusual commander-in-chief. And her commander-in-chief was God himself. And she should have consulted the commander-in-chief in terms of where had they failed. God had not failed them. They had failed their commander-in-chief. And they should have done as Joshua did when they lost the battle at Ai. That Joshua went before God and God revealed to him there was sin in the camp and they had to seek out a man by the name of Achan who had violated the plan of God in that issue and had stolen in the city of Jericho and he should not have taken anything. Now they should have realized before God that their problem was one of disobedience. So here's what they do. It indicates just how apostasy had worked its way into their life. It shows itself in their absolute superstition. They're no better than the Philistines. But look, well, for look what they do. So the people sent to Shiloh, well, go back into verse 3. I need to get that issue in. Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the ark of the covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies. Now here is one of their problems, one of the results of a religious apostasy. When you have a form of godliness, but you deny the power of it, when you have simply ritual and no reality, when you go through the motions, but there is no genuineness to it, one of the characteristics of that is superstition. Substituting symbols for reality. Substituting ritual for reality. And what they were thinking is that that ark in their midst is going to be like a good luck charm. Like a rabbit's foot hanging around their neck. Like a horseshoe over the door. Like a four-leaf clover. Or like a cross around one's neck, if one happens to think that's going to bring them good luck. Now, if you have a cross around your neck, I'm not saying you think that's going to keep any evil spirits away, but I hope you don't think that. Now, if it's the occasion for witness, that's something else. But that kind of attitude, or putting a little plastic replica of some Christian dead and gone up on your dashboard. This sort of thing. Is this going to affect anything for on your behalf? Well, that's what they were thinking about the ark. They were looking at the ark as you would a good luck charm. Let's get it in here so we can have some advantage in battle. So the people sent to Shiloh. The reason they sent over here to Shiloh, this is where the Ark of the Covenant was located in the temple there. And from there they carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts who sits above the cherubim and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. See, they're mentioned here because they're right in the middle of all this. They didn't try to stop it. As a matter of fact, they probably encouraged it as being a very good policy. It indicates their absolute spiritual blindness. You'll notice these men are already immoral men. And when you have immorality, you're always going to have blind spots in other areas too. And they had spiritual blind spots. They were immoral men, and they should have been spiritual leaders. So we're not being too hard on these two men who already had seen that they were sons of Belial, or in other words, they were absolutely, thoroughly sorry. And it happened as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp that all Israel shouted with a great shout so that the earth resounded. Well, it must have been like a high school pep rally on Friday at 3 o'clock. They're getting all fired up now. The big game's coming up. And here they've brought their mascot in. And this is, they're really working one another up. You've got to watch out for crowds. You know, when you get a lot of people together, we're all this way too. When you get a lot of people together, you can get people to do some absurd things. Carry on foolishly. And you and I have probably been in a crowd somewhere at some time or another, and you've acted foolishly. And, you know, in a church, a pastor or any speaker has to respect this fact that when you get people together, they're going to behave, they have a tendency to behave in a manner where they would never begin to behave that way as an individual, isolated. You know, dogs are like that too, so it does. So don't feel too bad. You get a dog out by himself, he'll walk down the street, he'll go his way, and you go your way. You get three dogs, and they got to prove something to one another. And believe me, I've had experiences with dogs through the years. But in Numbers chapter 10, in verse 35, we've got them shouting at this pep rally. They were on now that's going to pull through. Of course, the ark was a very important piece of furniture. I don't mean to take away anything from the ark. The ark represented the presence of God in the midst of Israel, and it was contained the tables of the law, and it was a very important piece of furniture. It was from the Holy of Holies. I mean, no other nation had a piece of furniture like that in any of their temples. Now, what the tragedy is, though, is that Israel was spiritually blind to the significance of the ark. and that the symbol had now become the reality. And that's idolatry. It was like an idol to them. Now, I'm saying to you what they said here. Then it came about when the arks set out that Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let those who hate thee flee before thee." Probably what they were saying right here on the spot. They were shouting. That's Numbers 10:35. This is their war cry. So they are they're jumping around. They ask why they lost, which probably wasn't a bad question to ask, but they gave themselves the wrong answer. They acted, you know what their answer was? It was the same kind of an answer that the Canaanites would have gotten if they had lost the battle. They figured it was some superstitious reason. And I might emphasize, this is completely in contrast to what happened in Joshua's day, in Joshua 7, Judges 20, verse 26. Well, let me tell you this. Apostasy can't be corrected by symbols. When you get a church that is rotting, you can't correct apostasy by symbols, by having a lot of pomp and circumstance. Now, everyone was excited about the visit of a certain religious dignitary in our nation in the last month. I've never seen such an outpouring of emotion in my life. It was astounding. I'll never forget it, and I've got a lot of lessons I've learned from it. I was interested in this aspect of it. Everybody was talking about what love and brotherhood all of a sudden was happening in this country, simply by the mere existence of symbols. Please tell me how the appearance of a symbol has made any effective change on our national life. Certainly hasn't done anything for the crime rate in Atlanta, I can say that much. Of course, he didn't get to Atlanta. Maybe we should have been blessed by a visit. Maybe it would have affected some difference in that. I'm saying to you that you cannot affect changes by symbols, by having more pomp and circumstance, by putting crucifixes on billboards, even by putting signs up, by making all sorts of decrees or public pronouncements. It comes down to declaring, "Thus saith the Lord," and letting it cut against the grain. That's what it comes down to. It doesn't come down to getting all caught up in symbols and getting great choirs together and singing and working one another up in a religious emotion. It comes down to repentance and changing the heart. You know, that's what Joel told Israel. God told Israel that through Joel. When Israel would, they were all broken up over their sin, over the crime problem in Israel. And what could they do? And they were tearing their garments. And God, you know what he told them? He says, "How about tearing your hearts and quit tearing your garments?" It's one thing to emote and to get all stirred up emotionally, but it's something else to want to change your ways. Now, when you start going around the land and telling people they've got to change their attitude about Jesus Christ and believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, change the way they live as a result, when you start preaching that kind of message, that the message of the cross that cuts against the grain, you know what's going to happen? People aren't going to like that. It's not accepted very well. That's not a populist message. And that is going to be a separating kind of message. Well, I'm coming back to this fact of Israel's apostasy, and they're trying to solve their problem with a Band-Aid. But you know what? They've got cancer, and you don't take care of cancer with Band-Aids. But that's what they're trying to do. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" They heard their pep rally. Boy, this intimidated them. You know, if it's like a football team running out on the field that night, and they're jumping up and down, popping shoulder pads, and then the other team sees them, "Whoa, they're really fired up. They're going to tear us up." Well, we know that doesn't make all the difference, does it, Bill? That you can come out jumping around, popping shoulder pads, and have all kinds of cheers, a big pep rally, and burn the other team in effigy. But all it takes is a few snaps of the ball to find out which team is prepared. Well, the Philistines are a little bit intimidated, and they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. The Philistines were afraid. They said, "God is coming to the camp." Now, lest you think these Philistines have all been converted and they've recognized the God of Israel, give another thought. They're idolatrous, and they believe in many gods. As far as they're concerned, Israel's got their God, they got their God. And all they think in this situation is that Israel's gods now come in the midst of. See, that's the way they look at the ark. That ark was their God, that was their idol. They've got their idol in there now, and it's going to be tough to whip them. So the Israelites and the Philistines are thinking exactly alike here. So the Philistines were afraid. God's come into the camp. They said, woe to us, but nothing like this has happened before. So they're a little bit intimidated, but I've got to hand it to the Philistines. They've got some courage. Pardon the expression, they suck it up. Though they say, woe to us, they go out and look what happens. They say, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. True or false? True. A couple of things said about that era in Israel's history here. The Philistines apparently had been reading your history books. And they knew exactly what God had done for Israel in Egypt. Of course, it's interesting, they bypass a period in history, which is a little obvious, but they just completely bypass it, don't they? Sort of conveniently set it aside. What period? What about all the miracles God had been performing for Israel since it had been in the land? How about that day that the Lord made the sun to stand still when Joshua beat the Canaanites on that day? How about the walls of Jericho? How about those battles? Well, they don't want to mention that. And so they just talk about what happened in Egypt. Well, so the Philistines, they ran away. No, they fought. And Israel was defeated. And every man fled to his tent, and the slaughter was very great. So there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Now that's no small casualty list. Israel's apostasy now has resulted in loss on the battlefield. Well, we can learn a lot about apostasy and how it affects a nation. One of the reasons you can know we're in spiritual decline in this nation is because we no longer have the capability to win on the battlefield. At least we do not. We haven't proved it. When was the last time we proved it? World War II? Did we prove it in Korea? I think we probably some wanted to, but I don't believe we really did. Or we wouldn't allow the North Koreans to stay where they were. We certainly have not proven it in other skirmishes. We didn't prove it in Vietnam. We lost tragically there. And it was, disgustingly, it was all under the name of peace and victory. And I remember vividly, as you I'm sure do, all the peace treaty signing and everybody bowing and smiling and signing all these papers. And then about a year later, we pulled out, let Vietnam topple. And now we see what's happened to South Vietnam. We've seen millions of Cambodians, I mean millions of Cambodians, actually being just eliminated, genocide. And where is the Fifth Estate? Where is the press? Where are the Jane Fondas? Now they're all anti-nuclear, which they know nothing about, like most of us. But they're telling us what we should do there. You see see how apostasy affects you. You've got so many blind spots. You have no moral vision. You have no moral vision. Every man's doing that which is right in his own eyes. And so the slaughter of millions of people in another part of the world doesn't bother you. Yet when it was the time when we were fighting the communists and we happened to stray and bomb a few communists here and there, you would have thought that the world had come to an end for all the demonstrations in the 60s. Well, I want to tell you, that is all the result of apostasy, and apostasy results in loss on the battlefield. It happened right here with Israel. She lost 30,000 foot soldiers. Now, that's not all. That's not the worst thing. I mean, they could have licked their wounds, regrouped, fought again, but look what else happened. The Ark of God was taken. Now, to the Philistines, that was like capturing Israel's God in a box. As far as they were concerned, they've got it. And three, the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Now this is the fulfillment of what has already been predicted about them in chapter 2. And we know that this was to have happened because of their own evil. So this was the discipline of God. Mark this down. God will take an unbelieving people and punish his own people when necessary. They were not guaranteed victory in battle simply because they had a covenant with God. Israel was taught a lesson in defeat, and God used the Canaan or the Philistines to teach Israel a lesson. Can God use other nations as wicked as or more wicked than we to teach us a lesson? It is quite possible. Well, let's go further. Now we get the aftermath. Now a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn and dust on his head. Now this man, we've got to hand it to him, he ran 20 miles. Now that's a pretty good pace and a pretty good distance to have taken care of this. Well, what's it going to take? 20 miles, I forgot, 18 miles, good run, maybe about 90-something minutes. less than 2 hours if he's in real good shape, running around six minutes, ten seconds a mile. And he's come in with this, the clothes have been torn and the dust is on his hair. That's a sign of mourning. That's like coming in, or we've seen, the drum and the fife, you know, coming down, and he's remembering the Revolutionary War, and with a bandage around the head. Well, he comes dragging in, and this was a symbol to everybody. They saw that, and right away, it's just like going about dressed in black at the time of death. They immediately knew what it meant. He was in such a hurry, he ran right. You see where he ran. Here is where, I don't have Aphek or Ebenezer, out 20 miles to the west, Shiloh. He ran to Shiloh, ran right by the city gate, past Eli, who was sitting there on the judge's bench, ran right by him, ran in the city, told everybody. Everybody got all upset. He says, when he came, behold, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road, eagerly watching, though he couldn't see because he's blind, because his heart was trembling for the ark of God. And old Eli, we've got to give him some credit. Eli had enough sense to realize that that ark was no magic wand, that it was not, and he was concerned as to what was going to happen. So he's sitting there waiting. So the man came to tell it to the city, and all the city cried out, ran right by Eli. Now he comes back out. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, what does the noise of this commotion mean? Well, that's all the uproar about. Then the man came hurriedly and told Eli. Eli was 98 years old at the time. His eyes were set so that he could not see. He was blind, probably from cataracts. And the man said to Eli, I am the one who came from the battle line. Indeed, I escaped from the battle line today. And he said, how did things go, my son? What happened? Then he brought the one who brought the news answered and said, Israel is, now he mentions the four things, actually, that have happened. One, they fled before the Philistines. There's been a great slaughter, that if they've had suffered heavy casualties. Your two sons are dead, Hophni and Phinehas, and the ark of God has been taken. And you'll notice that he's presenting them in the order of significance for the old priest. In the order of significance. He probably wasn't really surprised when he heard about Hophni and Phinehas. He knew it was coming to that for them. It's like a parent who has wayward children, and they're sowing to the whirlwind, and they're not really shocked when it happens. And so the thing that really floors them, the ark of God, has been taken. Nothing like that had ever happened in Israel. Nothing. And that ark, though it was not God, was a symbol of the presence of God, and this was serious. It came about when he mentioned the ark of God that Eli fell off the seat backward beside the gate. His neck was broken and he died, for he was old and heavy. He was fat from eating all of that fat meat, the goodly portions over which he could never control his appetite. So, what an ignominious end for an old man. What a glorious death. His two sons are killed in defeat after living an immoral life. He falls back over in a chair, breaks his neck, and dies. And he's fat. A high priest of Israel. Thus he judged Israel 40 years. We're not through. Phinehas' wife was pregnant and about to give birth. When she heard the news that the ark of God was taken and that her father-in-law and her husband had died, she went into labor, it should be translated. Says she kneeled down. This was the posture that women often took in that part of the world in giving birth to babies. They didn't go into the nice hospital and the nice white sheets and get a little anesthetic. But she kneeled down, gave birth, for her pains came upon her. A little premature birth because of the shock. And it says about the time of her death, the women who stood by her said, do not be afraid, for you have given birth to a son. But she did not answer or pay attention. She's apparently in such shock. All she can think about is the loss of the ark. Notice, that's what bothers her. She called the boy Ichabod. Now, the reason that she calls him that is because of a play on words here. Ichabod, saying, the glory has departed from Israel. Now, this is the way Ichabod looks in the Hebrew. And I'm going to show you the word for glory, and then you can see the similarity. That's Ichabod. This is a B, and this is an O. It comes out like this. That's an I, and then a hyphen it. C, A, B, O, D, H. And then the word for glory. The word for glory is this in the Hebrew. It is C-A-B-O-D-A, Kavod. She called him Akavod because Kavod had departed. She called him the glory had departed, for the glory had departed. So in her son's name, she memorialized the event. What is the glory she's speaking of? What is the Kavod? The Kavod was the ark. She's thinking just like all her peers. And in her own moment of great crisis, she still is so superstitious and like everyone else that she thinks that because the ark is gone, God's gone. That's what she thinks. She's an idolater, just like all of the rest. And she says the glory hath departed from Israel. The word departed in the Hebrew, in its noun form, indicates going into exile. It's translated that way in other places. To go into exile. The glory hath gone into exile. Almost a synonym for God here in her way of thinking. God has gone into exile. That's really too bad, isn't it? God's, what a view of God. It's not like Hannah's view, is it? You go back and read Hannah's prayer, and that'll encourage you that there were a few godly women. What a contrast between Phinehas' wife and Hannah. So there is a godly remnant, people who know God and hold on to God no matter come what may. And she said, the glory, the kavod, has departed from Israel, for the ark of God was taken. In her dying words, she is so superstitious and so infiltrated with apostasy that is she grieving over her husband? It may be. I don't want to read too much into what's not said. But she's certainly taken up with the fact that the greatest tragedy of her was that the ark was gone. We're not through. This ark really occupies a lot of attention. Now, the Philistines took the ark of God. They figure they have a real prize in their hands. And they took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. We've got a lot of geographical movements here, so I'm going to put this little homemade map up. If you have a map in the back of your Bible, you might want to trace it out. But here's what's happening now with the ark. I like this because I want to show you a lesson right at the outset. Israel has failed. Israel is not a whit. Do you know what the Philistines thought? Now, this is the one of the great tragedies of Israel's defeat. You say, well, it's just a defeat in battle. We lose a battle, it's just our own prestige as a nation. But when Israel lost a battle, it was more serious than that. You know why? When the Philistines or any other nation defeated someone else, as far as they were concerned, they had just beat their God. In other words, our God's better than your God. We beat you, didn't we? It's like the high school, college team, our mascot, you know, better than your mascot. Well, the dogs are going to eat the gators or something like that. The gators are going to eat the, what do gators eat? Bulldogs or yellow jackets, that kind of thing. Well, they looked on their God as being stronger than Israel's God. Do you realize how serious that is? That is the same as when a Christian tarnishes his or her testimony out in the world, and the world looks on and says, well, there you go, I showed you. I told you Christianity was just a lot of hot air. They said they were a Christian. Look at that, just like the rest of us. I told you, the best thing to do is just live for yourself. The best thing to do is, well, what makes your religion any different than anybody else's? See, look, you've got feet of clay. There's a tragedy of it because Israel's God was identified with Israel, rightly so, and then when the Philistines defeated them, Israel, in the Philistines' mind, our gods are better than your gods. And to add insult to injury, you know, the godly Israelites must have really wept over this. Look what happens. Look. It says they took the ark. Now, they moved it over here. They've taken it from Shiloh to from Ebenezer to Aphek, and now they brought it down to Ashdod. That's about 33 miles out to the west of it, Jerusalem. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. Now, this is a trophy. They've got something in their trophy case. But here's their God, and they got an image of their God. Language scholars have debated over the root meaning of the word Dagon. Some have thought in the past that it was a fish god. It had a head of a fish, the body of a human. They've taken it to the word for fish, Dagon. But it seems more likely that it comes from a word which means grain, Dagon. a grain god, a fertility god. This god had been around the ancient world for some years. The Philistines had simply absorbed it into their own pantheon of gods. And this was their god, and they had had him set up as in their temple, and they brought this ark, was like a trophy, and brought it in next to it. Then the Ashdodites rose early the next morning. Now listen, this is the lesson that you'll learn from this chapter. God's people may fail and tarnish their testimony, but God doesn't fail. God has to become his own witness. They weren't his witness. Israel wasn't his witness. Not at all. But so God becomes his own witness. God was not limited by their failure. He overruled and came around and made his point. See? That's how great he is. I think that's probably one of the reasons for 1 Samuel. That God was so great that he would take man's own failings and he'd go right around, move around man, go on and establish his own testimony. Watch how he did it. He said, they came in the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. So what did they do? They took Dagon and set him in his place again. They just figured, well, what happened? Tilt, earthquake. They don't seem to be particularly bothered by it. By the way, this is the very same area. They had already rebuilt it, of course. Well, you remember a man who was blinded and who he asked a little boy to just give me the pillars of this temple here. And he asked God to give him one more chance. And he flexed. And the whole thing came on everybody. On this God in the temple, several thousand folks. Samson. Apparently that didn't impress them, though. And they were right back at their old habits of idolatry. They've got their God propped up. So God comes in round two. And when they arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. How humiliating. Head, that's supposed to be where he thinks. Hands, strength. Completely humiliated. So the Philistines, well, they were victorious over the Israelites, but they weren't victorious over God. I think God made his point rather well. Therefore, neither the priest of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to that day, to this day. That's the day of the when the writer of Samuel was putting this down. Now, the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites. He's not through with them. God's only his own witness, see. Israel is, they flunked out. I mean, they're back in the grapefruit league. They're of no use to anybody. Oh, I'm sure there's a godly remnant. But they're of no use. So God's just taking things into his own hands. Then, now, the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites. It says he ravaged them and smote them. What do you have in your King James Version there? I don't remember what the word is. Hemorrhoids? All right, that doesn't help. You know, the New American Standard's even worse. Hemorrhoids. I thought maybe a subtitle this tonight. I started to say, could have said it Sunday, because we're going to come over here to the five golden hemorrhoids. That's the New American Standard translation of the word. Now, I don't know how the translators got hemorrhoids out of this word here, but the word is avolim. Avolim. I think the international version translation here of tumors is better, but we might can even improve on that, because I believe what's happened here is God sent a bubonic plague upon them, the Black Death. How do we know that? Because we know that rats are involved in this tragedy. Here's what happened. God sent them a disaster of great proportions in terms of the Black Death, bubonic plague. Now, mankind's known about bubonic plague for centuries. You know, it wiped out one-fourth of Europe in the 1300s. It's been just, what, in the last 100 years that it killed over 10 million people in India. And it travels in a germ on fleas that infest rats. And this is what has overtaken them. It causes, among other things, a swelling of the glands, the lymph glands in the groin area. Is probably what's involved here, and that is the reason why they're saying with hemorrhoids, or it should be with tumors, boils. the words you have in Deuteronomy 28:27. So this is no small tragedy. The people are suffering, but they don't know why. You'd think they might make some immediate associations, but they don't. So watch. Now, does the rest of the story here, does the way the ark moves in the rest of the cities, does that give you any idea what's going to happen? Wherever the ark goes, so goes the plague. This is, we got to get it out of our town. This is killing us. So if we get it out, we will be better off. Well, that's what happens, because you see now down through the rest of the chapter, you have it going to these cities. Then it goes down to Gath. I'm sure the citizens of Gath appreciated that. There was the mayor out front and everything. Hey, hot dog, here comes the ark. And just what we needed, the case of the bubonic plague. And so they sent it on up to Gath. I guess probably the Ashdodites had a little bit more clout than the Gathites did. And so they got it on down there. I guess there was a little boy probably never forgot that, though you wish he had learned a lesson from it. Little boy was taller than everybody else while all this was going on. He was, while everybody else was about 4 foot, he was about 6 foot. Probably was winning all the Little League baseball games and basketball games. He was really a terror. And that was a man by the name of Goliath. Goliath was growing up in Gath about this time, and he'll be meeting Israel a little later on. Well, back to Gath and to Ekron. They sent the ark God to Ekron. Well, the Ekronites, I'm sure, are really excited about this. With friends like this, who needs enemies? So it goes about 6 miles up to the north, Gath to Ekron. Happened as the ark of God came to Ekron that the Ekronites cried out, saying, "They brought the ark of God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people." Well, thanks a lot. So they decided to get it out of there. The ark sent away the ark of God, reading in verse 11. They sent it away. Let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us or our people. There was deadly confusion throughout the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. This plague was spreading among the people. Now, the ark of the Lord had been in the country of the Philistines 7 months. The Philistines called the priests and diviners. All right, enough's enough. We're losing too many people. This is ridiculous. We've got to get this out of here. So they call in their own religious quacks. That's what they were. Though they really believed in them, the diviners supposedly foretold the future. Look at the stars, tell you what zodiac you were born under, that kind of thing. They could read animal entrails, and they could converse with the dead, and all that kind of thing was wrapped up in the work of the diviner. So they say, "What are we going to do?" This is, they get the State Department out here. "What should we do with the Ark of the Lord? Tell us how we shall send it to its place." Now, lest you think these men have been to a seminary in Jerusalem and have picked up a lot of good theology, you've got to remember they're thinking just like pagans would think, which is sort of a part of the, it's a what we would call a universal approach to religion. Namely, when your God is angry at you, you've got to do something to appease that God. Of course, there's only special revelation indicates the trueness of that, and that God's wrath must be satisfied, and it has been satisfied in Jesus Christ. But they're thinking along the lines of propitiation. The gods are angry. Israel's God is mad at us, so we had better do something so that he won't be mad at us. Okay, that's what they suggest then. Don't send it empty. You return him with a guilt offering to satisfy him, propitiate him with gifts. Then you shall be healed, and it shall be known to you why his hand is not removed from you. All right, they said. What should be the guilt offering? What are we going to send along? All right. New American Standard, 5 golden hemorrhoids. No, not 5 golden hemorrhoids. 5 golden tumors. You know, I imagine that the goldsmiths must have had an interesting day when they brought in the order slip on this thing. They've been working there making pots and cans. They've got to come in here and make 5 replicas of gold of tumors. You would say, what is this? 5 golden tumors. Well, 5 golden rats. So they send these along according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. There were 5 Philistine cities. For one plague was on all of you and on your lords. So you shall make models of your tumors and the likenesses of your rats that ravage the land or destroying the land. And you shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will ease his hand from you and your gods and your land. Then they go on. Now, they're giving them a little preaching here. You can't go to the State Department without getting a little message along with it. Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened theirs? They'd been reading their history. They remembered what Israel had God had done on behalf of Israel in that period in history. When he had severely dealt with them, did they not allow the people to go and they departed? You better do this. Well, here's what to do. These Philistines were very superstitious. Here's their plan. Now, watch it. They're going to get a couple of cows. It says two milch cows. Now, that's not a misspelling of milk, but two milch cows. That's cows who have just calved. That is, they have little calves. And the calves have been taken away from mama cow. Little calves over here in their own little booth somewhere in their stall. And the two mama cows are out here. They give them a new cart, and they've never had a yoke. Hitch the cows to the cart and take the calves home away from them. Why? Well, because once they hitch these two cows up to this cart, probably with two big wheels on it, with the ark set in it, what they're going to do is determine that if these cows are supernaturally guided, that is, if according to the Philistines' way of thinking, if these two cows are guided by supernatural powers, they will not turn and go back to the calves. And they will not buck and break from the yoke. They've never had a yoke around their neck. And a cow that's never had it, been in that situation before, is going, you know, it's going to go and buck and pull and needs to be broken in. But not broken in, and they got babies at home. So that's, they figure that'd be a good test. So take the ark, place it in the cart, put the articles of gold which you return to him as a guilt offering in a box by its side, send it away, and let it go. Go out and watch. If it goes up, by the way, to its own territory, to Beth Shemesh, that's the city that means the house of the sun, probably a very old city, goes back to one of the name of Canaanites, the Canaanites had given to it. It's going from Ekron over to Beth Shemesh. This is about 15 miles from Jerusalem, not very far down the road, and they're going to watch it, see what happens. Here's their test. Then he has done us this great evil. That is, if these two cows take this cart and don't come back, don't break loose, and go right to this Israelite city, we'll know that their God did this to us. But if not, we'll know this. We'll know then that we shall know that it was not his hand that struck us, it just happened to us by chance. Just some bad luck. Just happened to be a breakout of the plague. Well, the men did so, took the two milch cows, hitched them to the cart, shut the calves up at home. Well, you know the story. What happens? Cows just walk, contented cows, just walk right on up to Beth Shemesh. Didn't try to break loose out of the yoke, didn't try to go back to the calves, went right on up. All the folks were out in the field reaping. It was harvest time. Most people in the city would have been out in the fields at that time of day. They looked up, here comes down the road, a couple of cows pulling the cart with the ark in it. They can't believe it. And the Philistines are probably, glad that's over. And they're watching to see what happens. And it comes up to a man by the name in his field, his name Joshua, the Beth Shemite. He stood there, and they even identified the place near a big rock. They split the wood of the cart, and they did a very fine thing. Because that ark had sanctified, in a sense, had set apart the cart. So they took the cart, made burn wood out of it, and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. Fine. The Levites took down the ark of the Lord. Now, we aren't told here, but until later on in the chapter, we'll see it in a minute, that the people get a little carried away. And it indicates their own lack of reverence and another result of apostasy. So this they do. And then, let's go on down to verse 19. We can find out what's happened, and they take in the ark. And then he struck down, that is, God struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. Now, the audacity. They had taken this as a very sacred article of furniture. Apparently, even the Philistines hadn't done that. And these have done it, though. And this is the same as entering into the Holy of Holies. But they realize what they've done. Now, it's not that God's down in that box, but they should have had greater reverence for it. God had set it apart and indicated they were profane and no respect for it. No respect for God's authority. According to Numbers 4:19-20, then, God does this. He struck down, and the New American Standard has 50,070 men. There's a bit of a problem here with regard to manuscripts, and I've got about a minute, and I can't go into all the details. It's a copyist mistake. It's not a problem with the original manuscripts. We don't know how the 50,000 got in here. Probably it's better to read in some Hebrew manuscripts and the Septuagint, take it as 70, translate or have 70 men here, not 50,070. The people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. But do you think they've even learned anything? It shows you how blind they are. Look what they say in verse 20. The men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God, and to whom shall he go up from us?" Let's translate that a little differently. Something to the effect of, "To whom will the ark go up from here?" I mean, nobody can get near this. You know what their problem was? They got a wrong attitude. They are thinking just like they did before, just like the Philistines. They thought nobody could stay near the ark just because of some magic in the ark. You know what their problem was? It didn't seem to dawn on them. Who could stand before him? Anyone who obeyed the Lord. God doesn't go around just wiping out people. God doesn't go. He didn't kill these 70 people because he's arbitrary. He just said, "Don't get near that magic box," and then bang, 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 bang. No. If they would understand the fact that God is approachable, but on the basis of obedience in His holiness, they would have understood it. But they have the wrong attitude here. Anybody can go before the Lord as long as they go before the Lord on His grounds, not their own grounds. That's the lesson here. God is only approached on the basis of His standard, His character. There's a great message there in how we come to Jesus Christ. You cannot approach God in any other way except through Jesus Christ. No magic is going to do it. And don't ever think, well, God's not fair. It's not fair that some people die and have to suffer an eternity without God and then forever in hell. Listen, God doesn't send anybody to hell. It's the unbelief of an individual that sends them to an eternal hell. And that is the truth that's taught here indirectly, because they had a wrong attitude. God was approachable, but He was approachable on the basis of His standard, His character. Yes, you can come before me. God just doesn't go around stomping on people like ants at a picnic. That's not the way God deals with His creatures. He loves His creatures. He loves us. But we must and we only can come to Him on the basis of the work that He has done. And that ark was a very good lesson in that, that mercy seat. You know the top of that ark? It's called the mercy seat. It was a gold plate, and that's where the priest sprinkled the blood from that animal that had been slain out on the altar of sacrifice. And that altar, of that offering of blood on that, you know what that symbolized? That the way God met man was on the basis of the shed blood. There had to be the sacrifice of an innocent victim. And God would meet man on the basis of that and on no other basis. And they had the audacity to lift that lid and look in there and ignore the fact that the top of that was very significant. That you can only approach God in the way He's designated, and that's through the shedding of the blood of a victim, an innocent victim. And they ignore that. He judges them. We're not through with the ark, and we're going to see the sequel to this episode and go more directly into the life of Samuel next week.